Good morning. Welcome to the House Committee on Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development. For those of you on the phone, we're here at the State Capitol in Salem. A lot of our committee is sitting on the dais. We have a few people in the audience and some slides from Christian Gregory on the screen. We're opening an informational meeting today on student food insecurity, and for the benefit of the committee, I just want to describe briefly the interest in starting this conversation. Since we're all still here and have the opportunity to take on some of these questions in the waning days of the session, we asked the Student Association and some others what things they thought the committee ought to be considering since we have this opportunity, and food insecurity was on the list, so we have a long list of people who are going to help us understand this issue, several from around the country by phone. We're going to try to move through with a good mix of pace and opportunity for questions. We have just a little bit over an hour in total. I understand that the people who are going to be testifying have that understanding, and so we've calibrated their presentations to strike that balance. We're going to start with Christian Gregory. Your slides are your first slide is on the screen. So if you give us a little cue, our able committee assistant Zach will cue through them as you speak. And if you're okay with it, we may interrupt you from time to time with questions.
Okay.
And if you could start, the other tradition I neglected to mention was that for our own committee records, as you start to testify, if you could introduce yourself, that would be helpful too. And so please get started.
Chair Reed and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Christian Gregory, and I'm here today representing the Economic Research Service of the USDA. On the first slide, you'll see my contact information and the title of today's presentation. You also see a disclaimer about today's presentation, which is just to say that what I'm presenting here does not represent the views of the ERS of the USDA, but the views of myself and my colleagues, Alicia Coleman Jensen and Matthew Rabbit, who are also part of our food security team. So I was invited here today to talk a little bit, give an overview of food insecurity in the United States as it's measured, and to talk about the Food Security Survey. I'm going to walk through these slides and try to just be as brief as I can while giving you everything I think you need to know. And I'll try to let you know if I'm going ahead or skipping a slide. These slides are obviously yours to keep as a reference. And as we go along, please feel free to interrupt. So if you go on to the second slide, the outline of the briefing is just to talk about what food security is, how it's measured, talk about our food security survey, the main findings of our most recent report, which was released last September, and talk a little bit about food security in general in the state of Oregon. So the next slide, please. So measuring food insecurity is part of the USDA's mission. The part that's relevant is in the language, kind of designing the USDA was to harness the nation's agricultural abundance to end hunger and improve nutrition and health in the United States. So part of that is accomplished with our food assistance programs, which you'll see a little information about right there. If you would go on to the next slide, please. So in 1990, there was the National Nutrition Monitoring and Related Research Act of 1990. And basically, it charged the USDA and the National Center for Health Statistics to develop standardized methods for measuring food insecurity. And very briefly, the way we measure food insecurity is to ask households who are responding to a survey from that's administered by the Census Bureau a series of questions about their food needs relative to what they were able to attain. There is a little theory behind it, but you don't need to know much about that, except that the way we determine a household's food security status is to look at how many of the conditions they affirm. And there's a little talk later about what the questions are like, so I'll save that for then. So in 2013, about 86% of households in the United States were food secure. The remaining households, 14.3%, were food insecure. And so, and we distinguish between households that have low food security and households with very low food security. And you can see the breakouts there on slide five for low and very low food security. So on slide six, there are some conceptual definitions from the American Institute for Nutrition. Those are there. If you would go ahead to slide seven, these are kind of operational definitions, which I think are a little bit more helpful for people. Food insecure households are unable at some time during the year to provide adequate food for one or more household members due to a lack of resources. So we think of this as the questions that are usually affirmed refer to disruptions in, you could say, the quality and variety of the diet of persons in the household. Households with very low food security show that the normal eating patterns of some household members were disrupted at times during the year, and their food intake reduced below levels they considered appropriate. So as distinct from low food security, very low food security indicates a disruption in caloric intake or a disruption in intake patterns. So we consider very low food security, both any level of food security is not hunger. We don't measure hunger and we can't measure it. But it does measure conditions that under which we know that hunger occurs. So if you go to the next slide, so this is just another kind of graphical rubric that tells you about the different definitions of food insecurity by low and very low food insecurity. Next slide, please. I'm on slide nine. So these are food security examples of food security survey questions. So at the least severe level, the respondents were asked, the food that we bought just didn't last and we didn't have money to get more. That is considered, this is asked about them in the last 12 months. And so then later in the series of questions, they are asked questions about whether they have to cut the size of meals or skip meals, which is considered a little more severe. And then later on in the series of questions, they're asked a question that says, in the last 12 months, did you ever not eat for a whole day? And this is considered a very severe level of food insecurity.
Great job.
Okay, if you look at slide 10, this, as I mentioned before, basically the little bit of theory behind the measure is that the raw score, or the number of affirmations that you have to the questions, is sufficient to determine your food security status. And there's a whole body of literature that has looked at this about whether it's a robust and whether it's a valid measure, and they consistently found that it's a very robust measure. So on slide 11, there are details about the current population survey, which is the survey from which we get our food insecurity information for our annual food security report. There are details about that survey there if you'd like to know more about it, but it's also the survey that we get unemployment information. It's the main source in the United States of our information about employment and unemployment. If you look at the next slide, slide 12, these are the main surveys in the U.S. that tell us something about household food security. So in addition to the CPS, the Current Population Survey, which is what we base our annual report on, there's NHANES, which is a survey that tells us a lot about dietary intake. The Early Childhood Longitudinal Surveys, which tell us a lot about childhood development. And more recently, the National Health Interview Survey has started looking at the 10-item household food security module for the last 30 days, as opposed to the CPS, which focuses on the last year. The National Health Interview Survey focuses on the last 30 days. Next slide, slide 13, gives you basically a graphic that shows the prevalence rate of food security and very low food security since 1996, when we started this measure in 1995. As you can see, there was a big bump up at the Great Recession, and while there is a slight downward trend, it certainly hasn't changed as rapidly as we would like. Next slide, please. So I'm on slide 14. This is a graphic like the one you saw before that shows the food security status of households with children. Roughly 20% of households with children experience food insecurity of one sort or another over the last year. And on the next slide, you will see food insecurity by different household characteristics. Obviously, income is a strong predictor of food insecurity, as well as the structure of the household. Single mothers who have children have very high prevalence rates of food insecurity and very low food insecurity as well. On the next slide, there is some breakout by residents and regions. On slide 17, there's basically a list of the contributing factors to food insecurity, the things that we observe that are correlated with food insecurity, obviously income, education, home ownership, employment, and disability. State-level economy and policies include average wages, cost of housing, participation in food assistance program, the unemployment rate, residential stability, and the tax burden on low-income households. The next slide kind of summarizes what I said and gives a little quantification of how much of food insecurity is explained by those factors. On slide 19, addresses how the measured prevalence depends on the amount of time that you measure it over. So, for example, for our yearly report, which comes out in the Wednesday after Labor Day every year, we use the last 12 months, but you can measure it on. We also measure it in that survey in the last 30 days, and it can be calculated on a daily prevalence rate as well. Although those have to be actually calculated and are not measured directly. The next slide, slide 20, basically, to sum it up, it says that food insecurity, is usually a recurring, although not a chronic, condition for many households over the year, and we base this on the difference between the 12-month and the monthly food insecurity rates. The next slide, slide 21, addresses the use of federal food assistance programs by food insecure households. And you can see that use of at least one of the three largest food assistance programs is about 62.2% of food insecure households. And the three largest ones are SNAP and the school lunch program and WIC. If you look at the next slide, tells us something about, I'm on slide 22, this tells us something about the use of community food assistance programs. So, for example, soup kitchens or food pantries, things like that. And as we might expect, households with low and very low food security have much higher rates of using community food assistance programs than households that are food secure. Slide 23 talks about average spending on food by food security status. Slide 24 and 25 basically address what we know about SNAP, which is the largest food assistance program, and how it can affect food insecurity. Some colleagues of mine did a couple of studies looking at the bump up in benefits for SNAP that happened with ARRA, the Reconstruction and Recovery Act after during the Great Recession, and they found that looking at it both ways, when benefits were bumped up and when they were allowed to lose value over the subsequent years, that food security status moved in the direction you would think, so that when benefits were bumped up, food security decreased, and as benefits lost their real value, food security increased. Disability, the next two slides 26 and 27, are basically address the fact that disability is a very strong predictor of food insecurity, and that's partly because of lower income, but it's also partly because of higher medical expenses. If you look at slide 28, this is a map that shows state prevalence of food insecurity from 2011 to 13. And as you can see, Oregon is basically right there with the national average. And then finally, the final slide, or the next to last slide, slide 29, I just plotted food insecurity rates in Oregon and in the United States since the Great Recession, roughly, since 2008. And in none of these years is Oregon statistically different than the nation as a whole. There's this little bump up in the most recent year, but it's not statistically significant. It's probably due to sampling error. And I would also just say that the state rates, both in slide 28 and in slide 29, are based on three-year averages, because we don't have enough sample size in the CPS every year to get a representative or a good state average that would give us good statistical quality. So on the last slide, there is just my contact information and the website for food security at ERS. And if you need any information and data, this is the place where you would go first, I think. And, of course, you are welcome to contact me or my colleagues that I've listed here at any time if you have questions about food insecurity in general. So I appreciate your time. It's really been a pleasure to give this presentation, and if you have questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Thank you, Dr. Gregory. You covered a lot of information very quickly. I guess, I have a question, but I see Representative Reardon has one first. So please, Representative Reardon.
No, thank you. Thank you for your presentation. A lot of information to digest rather quickly.
Yeah.
Do you measure anything to do with food quality? Because I believe that the lower quality foods, a lot of things, high fructose corn syrups that are used in some foods contribute to obesity, which is another huge issue. Do you measure that, monitor that at all?
So, Chair Reed and members of the committee, thank you for this question. The answer is that there are surveys that the National Center for Health Statistics does that do measure dietary quality. And what they show is, in general, is that Americans on the whole have not very awesome diets.
That's a technical term, right? Not very awesome. We like that one.
Not very awesome. I just like to keep it positive.
Yep.
The diets of adults and children in households that experience food insecurity of one sort or another, they are significantly less awesome or less healthy. So there is data about that out there, and there was also some research about that.
Okay, thank you.
So the question I had you covered kind of the broad overview of these issues, and of course our committee's higher education. We have a number of other people who I suspect are going to narrow down into how this affects higher education and students in particular. Are there any particular takeaways from your more broad perspective that we should keep in mind as we proceed through the rest of our discussion today?
Well, Chair Reed, I appreciate that question. I think that the message that one could take away is that access to food assistance in all its many guises is very important, and understanding which students would be the most at risk is also really important, and making connections between the campuses in the University of Oregon system and food pantries or other sources of food assistance would be really helpful.
Okay. Thank you. I'm looking up and down the dais just to see if there's any other questions. I think you gave us a good overview, so we appreciate it. And, of course, you're welcome to stick around for the rest, but I imagine you have a busy schedule, so we appreciate your time with us.
So, Chair Reed, thank you very much. I will hang up now, but please, if anyone has any questions or questions come up that you think I might be helpful with, don't hesitate to email me or give me a call. My number is on our website.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. So with that, we'll turn to Dr. Hanna from Cal State Sacramento. You're with us, Dr. Hanna?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Chair Reed and committee. For the record, my name is Lynn Hanna. I'm an associate professor at California State University in Sacramento, and I teach lifespan nutrition to our dietetic students. I'm here to speak to you about my research on food insecurity among students at my university specifically. And our last speaker from ERS is the expert on the numbers and how all that was assessed. I used a survey system that was based on the type of survey that they were talking about, that CPS, current population survey. Some of the background on why I was interested in this, as you know, there are many different types of support services in place to mitigate some of the effects of food insecurity, one of those being the school lunch program, and that has served 30.3 million K-12 students in 2014. But as I'm sure you're aware, this type of support disappears once a student graduates from high school. I'm concerned for these students because research shows that the food insecure adolescent, which covers ages up to age 20, may have poor academic performance. And in adults, we see that food insecurity is associated with poor health and loss of productivity. Now, this student population is a little bit different than your general household population in the United States because college students have other expenses that are unique to that particular population, such as tuition and that transition from being in the family household to having now be responsible for lodging and things like that. So some of their issues are a little bit different than our general household population across the country. The hypothesis that I had was that food insecurity has the potential to interfere with success in college. And given that food insecurity is closely associated with low income, I surveyed students who were Pell Grant eligible. And the Pell Grant system is one that is based on family or household income and provides grant resources to students who are from those low income families. And we wanted to know whether or not they were having greater issues with food insecurity compared to other students on their campus. So we used questions that were very similar to what you heard from the CPS survey. I asked students to identify which of the following would best describe their experiences with food in the past 12 months. So the first was, I had enough to eat, and that would be defined then as food secure. The second was, I had enough to eat, but not always the types of foods that I thought were best for me. And this would fit in with the USDA definition of food insecurity. Thirdly, I asked them, I sometimes did not have enough to eat. And fourth, I often did not have enough to eat. And some researchers have singled or separated out the responses to these last two questions and defined that as food insufficiency. So it's a subset within the food insecure group. But I think you can probably appreciate that many college students would answer the question number two, yes, I had enough to eat, but not always the types of foods that I thought were best for me, for reasons other than what general adult household populations would be making that statement. Students sometimes can be very hectic in their schedules. They may not be as good at planning their strategy for how they're going to have healthy meals and not as good at time management. So there could be a lot of reasons why they might answer affirmatively to fit into that food insecure group. So I really wanted to focus on the folks who fit into the food insufficiency where they sometimes or often did not have enough to eat. I also asked them about the frequency of the actions that they took related to that food insecurity or insufficiency, such as not eating for a whole day or access to assistance programs, such as the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or what in decades past we called food stamps. These responses were then also compared to several parameters based on demographics and included measures of academic performance by comparing their responses to their grade point average. So based on the USDA definition, 67.9% of the 848 Pell Grant eligible students who responded were food insecure, and 17.1% suffered from food insufficiency in the past 12 months. So that 17.1% stated that they sometimes or often did not have enough to eat in the past 12 months. The students with food insufficiency were more likely than other food insecure students to self-report unintended weight loss and weakly cutting the size and frequency of meals. When asked about the reasons for troubles with food, students with food insufficiency were more likely to report that money was the primary cause, where food insecure students, those stating that they had enough to eat but not always the types of foods they thought were best for them, cited time as the primary limitation. Students dealing with food insufficiency were least likely to indicate that they had heard of assistance programs such as SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. And lastly, all students who reported not eating for a whole day on a weekly basis had a significantly lower grade point average than students who reported doing this on a monthly basis or less frequently. So I feel that these findings confirm and are in agreement with a lot of other reports that food insecurity is an issue on university campuses. And I surmise that my findings are an underestimate of the number of students who may be struggling with food difficulties. Once a family or student is $1 over that eligible income for the Pell Grant, they will not be receiving a Pell Grant and may be forced to budget a greater percentage of their income towards education costs, thus putting more strain on having money for food. Campuses and governments need to be aware of this issue and take steps to support this specialized population. College students have expenses and experiences that are unique to the general population, such as tuition and conflict with the ability to work and meet high academic performance. I recommend that this involve regular assessment to determine the number of students in need, how we can predict those students so that we may reach out to them, and how effective any actions or interventions we've been taking have been successful. Many campuses have established food pantries, and I see that we're going to be hearing from some of those campuses across the country. And some governments have also made some adjustments to the SNAP, or the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, eligibility rules to specifically better meet the needs of students in higher education. Thank you for listening, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. I'm looking up and down the dais. I have one or maybe two questions. I want to make sure I understood something you said there about the marginal dollar making creating ineligibility. That's something we've seen in other programs. And does that suggest that there's value in a more of a slope approach rather than a cliff? Or did I misunderstand you?
Thank you for your question, Chair Reed. The issue with the Pell Grant eligibility is one where if you're above that 250% of poverty level, you're no longer eligible for Pell Grant funds. And that means then that you would be responsible for your own tuition, or you would need to seek other types of assistance, perhaps taking federally guaranteed loans for tuition or taking looking for scholarships and that kind of thing. And sometimes it's difficult for students to be eligible for grants, and that also can be trepidation about taking on extra loan debt while they're in college. And making those dollars stretch, oftentimes priorities go to the education costs and to housing, and students, and an anecdotal or in the survey questions that I asked them, well, what were some other reasons? They were saying, well, you know, I kind of have to make some decisions and some priorities, and I figure I can go without a meal in order to make sure that I can buy a book for my class.
Okay. And we've been talking about textbooks as well. Any questions? Representative Reardon, please.
Just wonder if her testimony could be made available.
Yeah, we would be interested if it's possible for you to it sounded like you had at least an outline you were speaking from. If you would be willing to share that with us, we'll make it available to the whole committee.
I can definitely forward that transcript to you.
Great. Thank you. We'd appreciate that. And I guess that is, well, what's your next on your research agenda?
I'd like to be able to compare food insecurity in different campus environments. Okay. We have large community college systems Those are different populations of students coming from different demographics. When you're looking at research institutions such as the University of California system, that's also a very different demographic of student population. And I think it's important for each campus, or at least each system, to have measures in place to kind of figure out, well, what are our students' needs and how can we customize those needs to our particular campus environment. So that's the type of research I'm looking at doing.
Very good. Thanks. Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, do you look at how the food services are provided to the students? Is it at the universities? What's the tradition now? Is it has to make money? Does it lose money? Is it subsidized? Do you look at people meal plans versus not meal plans? Have you looked at the financial aspect of this?
Thank you for your question, Committee Member Whitman. The meal services on campus are not run on a subsidized program, so there's no taxpayer dollar that covers those. Those are paid by student fees, and when students on my campus are housed in the campus dormitories, they're required to purchase a meal plan, and those funds go towards the process of
Not at all.
Working from my home office today, and unfortunately I have friends that visit with me, and they're kind of noisy. The issues with the meal plans on campus, those are definitely maybe not necessarily profit-making for the campus, but they are run through the university. It's not part of the university through the taxpayer dollar type of a thing. So it's a private enterprise that runs the food service and the meal dining process on our state campus. So the students who are housed in the dormitories are required to purchase a meal plan. And among the very few students that took my survey, the ones that were that said they were living in a dormitory, none of them indicated that they experienced food insecurity. We're mostly talking about students who are taking care of their own meals, or maybe even still living at home with friends and family, or are also responsible for providing meals for their children or for their adults or grandparents. Those are the students who are indicating that they're having problems with food availability. So in terms of assistance for them, in the past, California state law actually required that for a student to be eligible for that supplemental nutrition assistance program, they had to be working 20 hours a week or more, which conflicts with your ability to do well in college. So there were a lot of students that weren't taking advantage of that particular opportunity because the majority of the students don't work 20 hours or more. But many campuses have established food pantries, so that would be an additional resource that is more of a charitable run type of an opportunity. So our Associated Students Incorporated organization, the student government, has established a food pantry on campus, and that's being supported through donations, community support, student-run food drives, and having people, student volunteers, to take care of inventory and that kind of thing. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Hanna. We appreciate your testimony, and we'll distribute your transcript to the committee. With others, you're welcome to stay on the line and listen to the rest, but we understand you've got other obligations too, so feel free to excuse yourself if needed. Thanks for your time.
All right, thank you. I'll actually stay on the line, and if you have any other questions, just let me know.
Great. Thanks very much. So next on our list, we have Megan Patton-Lopez. We did hear Daniel Lopez-Ceballos. I'm not sure if Megan joined us since we got started. Megan, are you with us?
No, she's not. I'm Daniel Lopez-Ceballos, Chair Reed.
Great.
I'm speaking today on behalf of Dr. Patton-Lopez and myself.
Very good. Well, please go ahead.
For the record, I'm Daniel Lopez-Ceballos, Associate Director of Research with the Center for Latino Studies and Engagement at Oregon State University. And Megan and I conducted a study back in 2011 with the students at Western Oregon University looking at food insecurity. And I don't have to go into detail. I think the my colleague earlier that mentioned the food insecurity scales and what USDA did or does on a regular basis. I think that provides the background, a good background for our study. So what I'd like to talk about is that there's very little research on food insecurity among college students to date. One of the things that at the time when we started working on this issue, both Megan and I were faculty at Western Oregon, and we would hear from the students issues around not able to make ends meet. Part of our work, we reached out and connected with a food bank close to campus, and I started working with the students to try to identify the need for that. And as we went to the literature, we found there was really very little on these issues of food insecurity among college students. There's quite a bit of evidence about the detrimental impact of food insecurity on the health and well-being of children, particularly young children and adolescents as well, but very little on among college students. One of the first studies done in the U.S. was at University of Hawaii in Manoa, and they found that about 59% of the students were food insecure. That's our data. 45% of the students were food insecure or at risk. That was back in 2009. In our survey, so we looked at food insecurity. In our survey, we found that over half of the students at Western Oregon University were food insecure at some point during the previous year. So that's higher than what Chaparro found. We found, too, that having fair or poor health, being employed, and having an income less than $15,000 were statistically significantly associated with food insecurity. And on the other hand, good academic performance, a GPA of 3.1 or higher, was inversely associated with food insecurity, meaning those with a good GPA were more likely to be food secure. So that's what we found in our survey. I think we got to keep in mind a couple of things in terms of our sample. The Western Oregon University, as some of you may know, is a mid-sized university. The Oregon context has about half of the student population is a first generation. The percentage of Latino students mirrors the percentage of Latino students in the state. And so that I think that provides the context for what we found. Since our study that received quite a bit of attention, there be a few studies, mostly overseas actually, just a couple in the U.S. looking at that, and the percentage has been more or less similar to what we found. We are currently working with colleagues in Texas, California, and Pennsylvania to replicate the funding, our survey, and expanding. One of the areas that we want to look at more closely is some coping mechanisms among college students, and understand a little more of the context. I think we definitely consider that we need to look more closely at a student's risk behaviors, but also include social and economic factors. Certainly income, as we found, employment issues. In terms of employment, for example, there were, for those students that answered that question, they were working anywhere from 4 to 42 hours with an average of 18 hours a week. So I think that also needs to be considered, the possibility of the work and study programs and that sort of thing, but also housing costs, student loan debt. Also, one of the areas that we're included in our future research is exploring a little more about college student families with children. As our first speaker mentioned, single mothers with children are the group at the national level that has the highest percentage of food insecurity. And if you consider that, that's about 34-35%. The surveys to date among college students show that they're well over that percentage. Fairly, we think that the food boxes, food bank programs are good steps, good short-term measures. But definitely, there's a bigger context. Our previous speaker mentioned textbook costs, for example. So food is one of the few areas on a student budget that is flexible to stretch those dollars. But you have to buy the textbook for the class, you buy the textbook, and so forth. So that's the outdoor rent. But really, food is one of the few areas where there's more flexibility, where the students can play out, kind of thing, and stretch their dollars. Certainly, we think, though, that more than just the food pantries, one of the experiences at Western Oregon in particular was the consequence of this research was to, with the leadership of another colleague, to establish a campus garden. So for students to have another source of fresh vegetables. At Oregon State, since I've been at Oregon State, we've worked with the colleagues there to try to articulate connections between the dining and the food pantry that operates on campus to articulate more about some of the food that's left over from some big events and that sort of thing. There's certainly food safety issues, and Megan could tell you more about that. But certainly working that out. But beyond that, I think we need to think more about the increasing cost of higher education and how first-generation college students and minority students are particularly vulnerable. I think we need to be thinking about generational poverty as well. And for our, we want to give first-generation, low-income minority students a shot at succeeding. So with that, I'll answer any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you, Dr. Lopez-Savalos. Representative Gallegos has a question.
Hi, Daniel. It's Gallegos here. Hey, listen, I'm really curious about, I could have asked the other presenters too, but the question I've got in my head has to do with, I mean, there's nothing more cultural than food. And, do any of our studies sort of tease that out in terms of, we look at income levels, but I'm just wondering to what degree there's a variance in terms of income levels and cultural groups. So, for example, take a Latino community of students, and again, we need to look at acculturation, say, from traditional to acculturated in terms of diet preferences. But, I'm just curious, have we looked at that at all? Or do you know of any studies that have looked at sort of trying to tease that out?
Thank you, Representative Gallegos, for your question. There has been studies looking at that, and my colleague Megan has looked at that with first-generation Latino women, and I'm happy to share what we work with the Oregon Extension Service. Certainly, with college students, not much has been looked at it, but certainly that's in our radar for the future. I think specifically at this issue of when you move, particularly since we move away from the home to go to college quite a bit. So we're put in a different environment. And if we rely on campus meals, for example, it's not necessarily the food that we used to eat back home, or let alone the ability to cook or the ability to find the foods that you were used to in this new environment. So certainly I think a cultural lens to this in relation to food and the availability and the types of foods. Megan will tell you the nutritionist that are one of our core concerns is the ability of this campus environment to provide nutritious foods. That's at the center. And then as much as we can make that culturally appropriate, I think it's important to consider as well.
Gracias, Danielle. Follow-up. I appreciate your work. And I had to chuckle. I was thinking, as you were talking about my experience at the University of Portland, we had a lot of international students, particularly my Japanese students, who really had a hard time, eating in the university food service. But you're right. In terms of if we're trying to address first generation and low income and minority students, you really do need to take this kind of issue into account. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Gallegos, and thank you, Dr. Lopez-Ceballos. We need to, I'm unfortunately starting to look at the clock a little bit. We've got a number of other people to hear from. So, we'll offer the same opportunity. If you want to stay on and listen to the rest of our conversation, that's fine. But obviously, you've got other things to do, too. So, we're fine if you want to excuse yourself, too. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Chair Reed. I just like to say I'll forward our paper to the committee, and I'm happy to answer any questions via email.
Great. Thank you very much. I think we'll transition a little bit from the academic to the experiential perspective, and we have a number of people who are here in person. So Michelle Wiley and Robert Kirkpatrick, if you want to join us at the dais, and as you get settled, we'll ask Nate Smith-Tai, who I think we did hear from on the phone earlier, if you want to get started with your presentation, please.
Yes, thank you, Chair Reed, and members of the committee. My name is Nate Smith-Tai. I am the director of the MSU Student Food Bank here in East Lansing, Michigan. I'm also a doctoral student in the College of Education here at MSU. I'll try to keep my testimony relatively brief and focus on two general areas. One is how we operate here at the MSU Student Food Bank and a little bit of our history, and then also speak to the College and University Food Bank Alliance, which we helped co-found with Oregon State University. So first of all, let's get right into what we do here at MSU. MSU Student Food Bank was founded in 1993 was a result of a group of primarily graduate students, a few staff members, and some undergraduate students here at MSU that had gotten together on a pretty regular basis to do Thanksgiving baskets and holiday baskets for students that stayed over the break. As they were working on this project in the early 90s, they sort of realized, talking with folks in their departments and their colleagues and the people they talked to in university departments, those kinds of things, that there really was a need for this kind of service, food support service, at times of the year other than just the holidays. So the group came together, formed a little bit of a steering committee, went through and did a needs assessment focused on our campus, and realized the best approach to do would be to have a food pantry. We are a food pantry if you follow the terminology of that, but we called ourselves a food bank back in 93, and that thing's just sort of stuck. But we follow the mode of actually operating as a food pantry. And so we've just sort of grown from there. There were some of those initial growing pains, of course, trying to go through fundraising. We were able to establish ourselves as a separate 501c3. So we not only work with university development folks, but we also are able to do some direct fundraising on our own, and that has helped sustain us over the years and build our program. Currently, we are probably one of the bigger campus-based food pantries in the country. We serve on an annual basis for an academic year right around 4,000 students and their families. Now, that's not unique visits, but that's total visits. We do a biweekly distribution during the regular academic year, and we'll have anywhere from 250 to 300 people that attend our distribution. We serve primarily graduate students still. We're about 65% graduate students and 35% undergraduate students. In terms of the demographics of our student, of our client base, we're probably 50-50 in terms of domestic to international students, which is sort of a unique, position from being at Michigan State. We are a large research institution. Our total enrollment is right under 50,000. We have about 12,000 graduate students, and we have a fair amount of international students, both in the undergraduate and graduate levels. Most of the international students that utilize our services are graduate students, and there's a whole sort of other area there which I've been sort of starting to talk about with folks too, in terms of international students and especially graduate international students. We have an interesting dichotomy on our campus between very affluent undergraduate international students and less affluent graduate international students that are basically here on visas and grant programs and are generally trying to get by raising their families. Most of them have families their children's spouse who can't work because of visa restrictions. Generally around the average graduate assistant stipend here at MSU is right around $1,200 a month. When you consider that the university apartment is about $600 a month, that leaves them relatively, you know, only about $700 per month on which to live. And, you know, they also have visa restrictions. They can't work outside of their assistantship and a whole other host of issues. They're not eligible for SNAP or the, or what we call here in Michigan, the bridge card. So there's all these other sort of issues, and those are, that's a student population that was, has some very acute needs that we try and service as best we can here at MSU, providing them with some additional food and those kinds of things to help supplement. So that's an interesting sort of little area. I'm not familiar with how the international to domestic student ratios are in Oregon, but here at MSU, it's an interesting thing, especially with the growth of the international student population, which is correlated pretty strongly with the dip in appropriations that we've received from the state. But that's probably another issue for the Michigan legislature to address. But as I said, we are very, during the summer, we go to once a month distributions. We distribute a wide array of foods. We purchase our foods from the Greater Lansing Food Bank, which is the regional Feeding America USDA supplier for about a 7-county region here in mid-Michigan. And we are, like I said, we primarily focus on fundraising to purchase those foods to distribute. We also do accept donations of food product as well that we distribute to our clients. Our clients are all MSU students. We only serve students, and they are, our eligibility requirements are only that you're currently an enrolled student and that you do not currently have an on-campus meal plan. So most of our students either live off campus or live in university apartments that utilize our services. So that's the general sort of gist about the MSU Student Food Bank. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have about our experience and some of those kinds of things. I would real briefly like to touch on the College and University Food Bank Alliance, which, as I mentioned earlier, was, is an organization that we helped to co-found with Oregon State. One of the benefits, I guess, of being the first and for the long time the only campus-based food pantry and food program in the country is that when other campuses are starting to look into doing this, we're sort of coming to the top of their Google searches and get a lot of contact from campuses. And as I was going through this, it sort of the peak maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I was getting contacted 3 to 4 times per week from other campuses. And it occurred to me that it would probably be a good idea if we had some kind of connection point for all these different folks that are out there working on food insecurity on their campuses, because in a lot of senses, and I think a couple of the earlier presenters alluded to this, it is, there are unique circumstances for being for providing these kinds of services on a campus. And part of that means that you're doing something unique on your campus, and you're also doing something unique that a community-based food pantry partner might not have those same kind of experiences. So a lot of times you just sort of figure it out as you go. And so there's a lot of trial and error. And one of the things we're trying to do with FUPA was to have a national body and organization that could be a point of connection for all the different folks sort of operating in the islands on their different campuses to connect, share resources, share best practices, share ideas, bounce questions off people facing the same kinds of issues. So that was really where FUPA was born, sort of out of these constant contacts I was getting from other campuses, and happened to just sort of serendipitously discover that Claire Cady, who was the director of the Human Services Resource Center at Oregon State, which houses their campus food pantry, was also having these kinds of discussions. So we got connected, came up with the idea, and our food was sort of born, as I said, in around 2012, 2013. Right now, we're still an online community. Our website is coupa.org. And we have about 187 members. We started with about 13, and there's now 187 members. And I've already heard that Cal State Sacramento has a campus-based food pantry, and they're not a member yet. So there are other campuses that are also out there that aren't members of CUPA yet. We are, as I said, an online community, have a forum, have regular blog posts and newsletter, those kinds of things to share resources, share best practices, and a place for people to have ideas or to ask questions, share ideas, and those kinds of things. We are actually meeting tomorrow on another teleconference to begin the planning stages for our first conference, which we will hopefully hold sometime next year. And we're looking at doing it at the IUPUI in Indianapolis.
Very good. Well, I think we want
to... Sure.
We probably want to wrap up at that point and just make sure we hear from the other folks who are with us in person from the Oregon perspective, and then we'll see if we have some questions for the three of you. So who wants to go first?
Okay. Chair Reed, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michelle Wiley, and I'm here representing the Portland State University Food Pantry. Our food pantry was established in 2009 to serve as a supplemental food source for students. As our previous speaker demonstrated, there was a little trial and error in the last, six years. Yeah, there we are. And as of this last term, having previously been managed by the Associated Students of Portland State University, we have moved to a student-operated service with a more formal business model due to the need and the need from the students at Portland State University. Currently, how we function is we rent a room, which the university pays for, and we have a food pantry coordinator who works 15 hours a week. It is also paid by the university, but that is the only payment that we receive from the university, or is the only sort of funding supplementation. The rest is provided via grants, monetary donations, and food donations. We also purchase food from the Oregon Food Bank, about $300 a week of food from the food bank. We have 40 volunteers who serve in the food pantry who work about 40 hours a week. And let's see, we get about 1,500 to 3,000 pounds of food brought in per week in our food pantry, and it does go very quickly. So there is a high demand there. Demographically, we don't take in that sort of information from our students because of a fear of stigmatization for food insecurity. Would be comfortable saying that we do see a lot of student parents in the food pantry, but there really is no specific demographic that uses it more than any other. It's a really wide sort of birth of students. Some partnerships we have with the Oregon Food Bank, we have a harvest share that we do I believe once a term, but it might be more frequently than that. I can get back to you on that, which provides produce and produce from the Oregon Food Bank to students, and it's been wildly successful. There's always a line throughout campus to get to it. I think. Sorry, I'm a little bit nervous.
You don't need to be nervous.
That's if you have any other questions for me, I can provide more specific details. Okay. But that's a brief overview.
Okay, very good. Well, let's hear from you, Mr. Kirkpatrick, and then we'll see if we have questions about the pantry experience at any of the three campuses represented. You've got slides.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So,
and if you could, you know, the microphone doesn't need to be very close, but if you could just point it in your direction, that'd be helpful
good.
Too. Great. Thanks.
Good.
That's great.
We're good. Yep. All right. So, Chair Reed and representatives of the committee, thanks for letting me come here and talk today. My name is Robert Kirkpatrick. I'm the brand new out of the box sustainability coordinator with Associated Students of Lane Community College. And I want to talk to you about our food pantry we started on campus. On March 2013, the Sustainable Food Committee on campus surveyed students to reveal a high need for a food pantry for low-income students. Students then, seeing that need, continued to organize together and work to find an allocated space. I had regular meetings with the Board of Education for Lane Community College to find support. By May 6, 2014, the LCC Board of Education voted to approve an establishment of the Rainy Day Food Pantry. By the time we opened in the summer of 2014, we had served over 600 low-income students on campus. On this first graph, you can see that from this past year, we have served almost 500 children and over 2,000 in total people through our food pantry on our campus. On this one, we can see that the differences between the number to the total of people served, the adults and the children and the households. On this graph here, we have the days in which we were open. On the left side, on the right side, we have the number of people served. And so we've tracked like when we're open and how we're able to help people, and when we've kind of found where we have staffing issues and find out when we're not helping people. So the support we've gotten for the food pantry right now. Lane Community College Foundation has provided a $10,000 grant to stabilize operations. this would include things like if the fridge breaks and we need to keep items cold, we have a $10,000 grant to get a new fridge and keep items safe for students. The LCC students recently just passed a fee referendum to add $1.70 to their student fee to help support staffing for the food pantry, seeing that it is an important need. Three work study positions have been provided to make sure that somebody can be in the food pantry. Food Flint County gives regular donations and supports the students, the student-run initiative. Additionally, the student government gives us $150 a week to go shopping for additional goods, such as canned goods like canned corn or green beans that can be stored kept for students on a need basis. Looking forward, there are some things we need to do some more. We need to be able to get more quantity and variety in our food. It doesn't really matter that we have maybe five boxes of the same case of beans, and that's all we have. We need to expand our storage space so that we can hold more food for the quantity and customers that we're getting. We're trying to integrate into like a broader network of organizations working with food insecurity, so that we can get more work done and keep more track of things and reach out to more students. We're seeking strategies to promote students to grow their own food. So we have a garden on campus that we're working with to give away seed packets and workshops and classes and doing vermicomposting so that we can teach students how to grow their own food. And then also working with the possibility of an on-campus farmers market so that not only can students learn how to grow their own food, they can take any excess and try to turn it into a supplemental income for themselves to kind of help with that insecurity. And that's my email at ASLCC Sustainability Coordinator @gmail.com.
Rolls off the tongue.
It's a long one.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Questions for any of these three? We also have a person on the phone, remember. You can certainly ask a question. Okay. Go ahead.
Thanks, Chair Reed, members of the committee. Thank you for indulging me. I was just wondering if your food banks for your two campuses served only the constituency of students, as the one in Michigan at MSU does, or if it's open to the broader community.
Or I guess something in between, like
something
campus
between
community,
what's the model?
But not students. Yeah.
As far as I know of, we serve only students. Like I said, I just took the position, so there's some information I'm still learning as I go. We do have the students sign in each time, and new students, they fill out a form. New people come, there were new residents come or clients. They fill out a form for the Food Flint County Food Bank that we keep records and track of.
At the Portland State Food Pantry, we do check student IDs and ask if they're enrolled in one or more credit hours, but that's the only sort of information that we take from them. So we do check their IDs.
Thanks. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentations. I guess this really hurts, this topic, and that how America would have so many needy people for food, how Oregon that has all the food, produces all the food we do, has a need like this. We have to provide food. As a commander in the military, first thing you do to troops is be sure they're fed. They can't do their mission unless they're fed. So I understand that. Do you work with the university and the community into trying to find these people jobs so they can, the solution is to have them have money to get food, right? And do you work? You know, I think the food bank, you do God's work in what you're doing. But what we need to do is we're not solving the problem if we can't get them where they can financially support themselves. So I would encourage some way of having monthly meetings or quarterly meetings and saying, hey, and having some handouts or having those people there at the food bank to say, hey, I have a job for 2 hours of, they give them to the athletes to sweep the gym floor or something like that so they can have money. So, I think you're doing God's work. But I think it's embarrassing. We've got to find ways to have enough income for these students that they don't need to have food banks. So that's my sermon.
Sermon has ended. Thank you. Anyone? Any other comments or questions?
Could I respond to that?
Yeah, please.
I would agree wholeheartedly with you that we do need to help students find jobs. I moved to Oregon in 2012, and this is probably the first employment I've been able to find myself in 3 years. I have printed out hundreds of resumes, filled out applications. I have walked up and down the streets of Eugene putting them in, talking with managers, sometimes going back a couple days in a row, having great conversations, sometimes getting an interview, but still no unemployment. It can be hard, and it's discouraging.
But that, you succeeded. That's good for you.
And that's something that we are working on. We are working on trying to come up with a way to help students. If they cannot find employment, then they can find another way to, be it sell greens. If they can do art, then they can sell art. If they can find some way to provide for themselves.
Thank you. Appreciate that. I would say in response as well, time permitting.
He's looking for you.
I have two jobs, and I live in the city of Portland, so you can imagine how expensive my rent is. And I, too, find myself food insecure. And so I wouldn't necessarily pin it specifically on finding jobs, but there's sort of a work-life balance you have to strike. And when you're working two jobs, when you're also going to school full-time like I am, there's only so much you can take in all at once. So I think that our pantry really serves that, because a lot of our students are not at a typical college student age. Most of them do work and go to school full-time. Some of them have children. So the food pantry right now is really just sort of a Band-Aid measure to kind of catch things as they come. There's a lot of work that needs to be done in many different sectors to sort of ameliorate that issue, but I totally understand where you're coming from. Employment is a huge one.
You know, this exchange prompts a question for me. I hadn't thought about this before, but have food banks on campus existed long enough to create sort of the, and I realize I'm saying something that might be a little risky here, but sort of the food bank equivalent of an alumni association with folks who could then be involved after they have graduated and are more successful? Has that created a sense of people who want to support the mission of the food bank after they've moved on? Has that existed either? I'm getting some nods from behind you, so maybe you may be getting bailed out and may get an answer later. If you don't know, that's fine.
There's nothing.
We can defer it.
No, there's nothing with that I know of at Lane Community College.
Okay.
I do know, like, we've added work-study positions, and the students have increased funding to be able to add more positions.
Mm-hmm.
But aside from that, that's all I know of. It would be nice to see that, but I don't know that we've seen that yet.
Maybe that's something to think about as you're going forward and keeping that connection with people after they leave the university or the community college. Okay, so if there aren't any other questions, we thank you for being here. We have two more people to hear from. I'm also aware of the fact that another committee is going to be using this conference line in a few minutes. So unless there are last comments from Mr. Smith-Tai or anyone else who's on the phone, I think we're gonna say goodbye on the phone and complete the last bit of our hearing offline. Any last words from anyone on the phone?
This is Nate at MSU. Thank you, Chairman Reed and members of the committee for the opportunity. And I would just mention that if you have any questions about what we do at MSU or with CUFPA, please feel free to contact me. I believe the committee staff has my contact information. Happy to talk with you anytime.
Thank you very much. We do. Thank you all very much for the presentations from the phone. We'll connect with you later. Goodbye.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And that leaves us with Patty Whitney Wise and Jessica Cole, please.
Good morning, Chair Reed and members of the committee. I'm Patty Whitney Wise, Director of the Oregon Hunger Task Force, and Representative Reardon serves on the Hunger Task Force, which was created by the legislature and includes legislators, state agencies, and nonprofits. I appreciate the opportunity to testify this morning. The Oregon Hunger Task Force has helped to substantially reduce hunger in Oregon over the last few years, bringing down food insecurity. At one time in our illustrious history, Oregon was number one in hunger back in the early 2000s, and we really doubled down and did a number of things, including expanding the SNAP or food stamp program, other federal child nutrition programs, and things like a refundable earned income tax credit and a refundable child care tax credit, recognizing that often other expenses in a family's budget put pressure on their food budget. So with those things combined, we moved from number one down to number 23 in the country. The recession did set us back, and I think, but not as much as many other states. And we do still have a lot of work to do here in Oregon. We actually are, in many ways, the Appalachia of the West. We've been a low-wage, high-cost state for a long time. And as we looked at the causes of hunger, those things impact people in many different ways. When we're talking about students, I think you've heard today that they're in a unique circumstance where they're paying tuition, room and board often, have other expenses, are trying to work at least part-time. And it makes it more likely with the Western Oregon University study and others that a larger majority of college students are facing food insecurity. As one presenter mentioned, there isn't a school lunch program like there is up through high school for these students. So we have I'm really abbreviating this. You have my testimony on OLIS. But we have several recommendations for you to consider and would love to work with you over the next year or two to look at what really makes the most sense. We include in our list providing additional financial aid, lowering student housing costs, funding additional work study. And this is particularly important because with the SNAP program, with the food stamp program, a student has to either be accepted as a work study student, whether or not they work, or working 20 hours a week. So if you're a student working 18 hours a week and you're low income, you can't access SNAP right now. We could, as a state, however, apply for a waiver or a demonstration project to work with students to see if we can provide SNAP for more of those students. It's very laudable that there are food pantries on campus sites, that only is meeting part of the need for these students. And if we were able to access the federal SNAP program, that could help a whole lot more students. So again, this is a little bit of a laundry list, but we're very interested, and I know Representative Reardon will keep this issue alive with the task force as well, to work with you on solutions for this population. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I suspect we will have questions. Representative Hayden, do you want to ask now, or do you want to hear from the other presenter and then hold it?
I'd ask now if I could.
Okay, go ahead.
That's fine. Might have to go before this is over. Just very quickly, I applaud all the interaction that the Oregon Food for Hunger and Oregon food banks do with the nonprofit organizations as far as distribution through food pantries, and visited several of those in my local district, and wonderful organizations working very hard through volunteerism and dedication. Quick example on the flip side of that, or the production side of that, I was approached because I raise grass-fed beef cattle to provide a cow for our Hunger Month up here for the tacos, which we had a select cow for that, about 1,200 pounds, and they only wanted 50 pounds of ground beef. And so I went to the food bank organizations locally and said, hey, I've got 1,000 pounds of beef here. Do you want it? And found out, and I don't have a lot of experience with this side of it, found out that they were unallowed to accept that beef. And it seems to me that there could be some effort, or at least look at, we've got a wonderful organization of auctions that are spread out throughout the state. We've got a lot of ranchers that would be willing to donate half a truckload, or cows get out of cycle for their breeding programs, and so those often go to auction. But there's no way for those farmers to donate those cows either through an auction or directly. They can have them slaughtered at a USDA slaughterhouse and make only ground beef, and then if they try really hard, they can get that donated. So it seems like we could reach out to suppliers, not only for beef. I say that just because that's an example. But why don't we have more involvement in the production side of it rather than, based more on all federal grants and monies to buy the food?
Sure. Representative Reed and Representative Hayden, you are correct that in some instances the beef is not allowed to be accepted by food banks. There have been a number throughout the state that have primarily through slaughtering their beef through USDA certified programs. But it is something that a number of legislators over the years have been interested in looking into, and I will make sure to take your concern back to the Oregon Food Bank and have them get in touch with you to talk about other options as well.
Thank you.
Representative McCune, do you want to, I'm wondering if we should hear from Ms. Cole first.
This will just be a quick follow-up on Representative Hayden. I've had the same experience with seafood in my community where we've had a plethora of salmon available, and trying to find a way to make that accessible to local food banks is a heavy lift. We've been able to do it with a lot of effort, so it's possible, but it's not an easy thing, and I'm hoping we can find ways to simplify that process.
Thank you. Ms. Cole.
Thank you. Chair Reed and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jessica Cole, and I'm the Associate Director for the Center for Student Health and Counseling at Portland State University under the Division of Enrollment Management and Student Affairs. I'm also the co-chair for the Committee for Improving Student Food Security at PSU. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you about the pressing issue of student food insecurity. As you heard today, food insecurity is the state of being without reliable access to or the ability to acquire sufficient quantity of affordable, nutritious food. In the summer of 2014, I conducted the first campus-wide food insecurity assessment at Portland State University using the USDA Adult Food Security Survey as a model. The survey was sent to over 19,000 PSU students enrolled in one or more credit hours in the 2013-2014 academic year, with a response rate of 22%, which is very good for PSU students. Of those that responded, 59% stated that at some point in the academic year, they experienced some sort of food insecurity as defined by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Student respondents reported engaging in many of the same strategies that Dr. Hanna had reported earlier from her study, cutting meal size, skipping meals, finding free food on campus. After the study, I and my colleagues formed a collaborative committee of students, faculty, staff, alumni, and community members dedicated to identifying the drivers of student food insecurity, as well as aiding students in acquiring the food they need to sustain themselves and their families so their energies can be focused on their academic endeavors and not on worrying where their next meal will come from. One example of our committee's efforts is a recent partnership with the Oregon Food Bank called Harvest Share. Harvest Share has allowed us to bring free fresh fruits and vegetables to campus once a month. In the three Harvest Shares we've held on campus, we've served 1,386 households and over 3,600 individuals, distributing 22,478 pounds of produce and bread. And that's just three times. Another example of our committee work is partnering with Multnomah County Department of Health to provide space and resources for outreach specialists to be on campus 3 days a week to meet with students and assist them with determining eligibility for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, emergency utility assistance, and other such benefits. Our unique student population is often comprised of working students pulled in many different directions, and having these office hours on campus has not only provided a stigma-free environment for students to receive aid, but students receive one-on-one assistance navigating what can be for some a challenging application process. Hunger among our students is a real and persistent issue being driven by rising tuition and unmet financial aid need, rising cost of living and an insufficient minimum wage, and state, federal, and university policies that could benefit greatly from being more collaborative with college students rather than prohibitive. The results of a well-nourished student mind and body is a win-win for everyone. It results in tuition dollars and retention for the university, and an educated graduate who returns to the community to become a contributing, productive member of our economy and our society. I urge you to consider the health and developmental welfare of our students and their families, and what the impact the policies you form and the decisions you make will have on their choice between paying for books and paying for food. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And you can see by the departure of some of our members some other things that are required of us at 10, so
sure.
It's not any reflection on what you're saying. Any questions for either of these panelists?
Well done. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So you were nodding just to, very quickly when I was asking the unfair question to the students before about the way to connect and maintain connections with people who have participated in food banks. I was guessing from your nod that maybe you had something to say about that.
Your question, yes, Chairman Reed, the question was about the Alumni Association or keeping connections with the food bank. Since our pantry has been established for about 5 or 6 years now, we have had a lot of returning students who have returned to volunteer. But we also have a strong connection to our Alumni Association, who have set up a consistent quarterly donation. I believe we have a club, the 1560 Club, who give $1,560 to the food pantry. And then we also have a donation option through the Alumni Association to the food pantry, and a relationship with the University Foundation for the student food pantry.
Good to hear. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I don't see any other questions, so I think we will leave it there. But thank you very much
thank
for the testimony.
For the
it was a good conversation, and I suspect we will return to it during the interim and the next session. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Colleagues, we don't have any other meetings scheduled. I hope that we might have an opportunity to meet again on some good topic before we adjourn the session. But for the present time, there's nothing else scheduled, so please stay on top of your emails and phones, and maybe we'll be together again before the final gavel drops. But we're going to drop the gavel for today.
Thank you.
We're adjourned.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're adjourned.
Thank you.
For today.